You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
Happy Wednesday, everybody. Everybody across this beautiful country of ours as we settle in. And life's getting back to normal. Kids are at school. And this morning, where I live, and for many, many, many people, Ontario just rolled out the details of their vaccine certificate, their vaccine passport. And I want to talk about that, and I want to get views. I know there's a lot of views on this. I know there's a lot of people, the maybe 800,000 people that voted for Max Bernier, that are furious about this. They regard these as an infringement on freedom. They regard this as big government tyranny. And I was thinking about the arguments that this last election polarized opinions on that. And I thought, okay, maybe we should be more gentle. Maybe we should really try to encourage people and say, you know, if you don't want it, you know, take a test. If you don't really want the vaccine, take a test. You don't have to worry. We're not going to, you can get on a plane. This morning I got on a plane. I was at the airport because I was flying back from Toronto to Ottawa from the election. And I spoke to the baggage handler. And she asked me, you know, have you been in contact with anyone who has been with COVID? No, no, no. You know the protocols. And then she and I struck up a conversation. And I was thinking about her this morning because she said, why aren't people getting vaccines? She asked me. I said, I don't know. She asked me, we saw everyone dying. We've looked around the world. We were begging for these life-saving vaccines. And now we've got them. And she said, people aren't taking them. You don't know what I'm dealing with every day here. She's there in a mask and blue rubber gloves taking documents with people, and she does not know if some are vaxxed and some aren't. And her job is scary. I thought, that's it. You know, my position's been clear on this because it's not my position. This idea that we all have these personal, there's a position backed by rationality and science. And there's another position that has no science and frankly no rationality, but it's got an emotional truth, quote unquote, to use the term of vogue, an emotional, like some people may not be comfortable. Some people may not trust. Those are your own issues. Those are real. There are some people who are afraid of flying. There are some people who are afraid of heights. There are some people who are afraid of dogs. Okay. Because dogs can bite people and planes can crash. They don't do it statistically very often. And the fear has no logic. People who are getting in their cars every day but are afraid to fly, much greater chance of dying in a car accident than a plane crash. Fear is not rational, but it's a truth. It's not like you can tell someone just get in there. There are people that have psychological reasons for all sorts of positions, and we understand that. I get it. But those aren't fear of flying. Your fear of flying is not an infectious, deadly disease. So we treat it differently. You don't want to fly, don't fly. Doesn't bother me. I'm not going to force you to fly. But your fear of flying doesn't affect me. As the law says, your freedom to swing your fist ends at my nose. And your freedom to spread germs ends at my lungs. And let's just, as Doug Ford, the progressive conservative premier of Ontario, announces the rollout, and it's a reasonable thing to do, of the vaccine certificate. Let's think of that woman that I spoke with this morning who's dealing with people. I'll tell you what she wants. She wants to go home to her family safe. You don't want to be in a hospital. I'll tell you, from speaking to doctors, they don't want to be late and going home to their kids, treating people in ICUs who refused a free miracle vaccine that is safe. So these aren't feelings. Let's just go at the data. I'm just gonna, like, the data is overwhelming. Not the data of the cost of COVID, 27,000 dead Canadians. These are people like my Uncle Charlie and many others, fathers and brothers and mothers and sisters and kids who are no longer here because of COVID. This is not the billions and billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars we've spent to try to support workers who had to stay home so we could avoid more death. Vaccine certificates and passports work, straight up. They work. The data is overwhelming. It's been tried. So we know the vaccines work. We know that the fourth wave is the fourth wave of the unvaccinated. This is not difficult. This is data, hard truth. You have the vaccine, you are significantly safer. Now, one of you is going to say, Evan, there was someone who got double-shotted from the vaccine who ended up in the ICU. Yes. If you wear a seatbelt in your car, you are, and your car has an airbag, you are significantly safer than the person with no airbag and no seatbelt in a car accident. Can you still die? Yes. Statistically, though, much less. Let's be candid. Yes, you're not perfectly safe double vaccinated, but you are so statistically much safer that we would not, and if we get to herd immunity at 85%, 90% vaccination, this thing goes away. But those 20% that don't want it, that's not happening. They're standing in the way of our society opening up, our freedoms. The people who are fighting for our freedoms by not taking it are literally the very same people who are standing in the way of the rest of our freedoms. It is that simple. And when you look at the data of what happened to places that decided to implement a basic vaccine certificate. How societies aren't doing this, I don't know. When the president of France, Emmanuel Macron, said, we are going to have a straight up vaccine passport. You need this to get in everywhere. Guess what? A million people who did not have the shot because they're like, I don't need it. They got it. They're like, you know what? I'm going to get it. Just like your kids get the shot for measles and mumps. It is not hard. It's an incentive and it works. When BC said, you know what? We are going to do this. Guess what? 200% jump in booking appointments for vaccinations over 1 week. 200%. These are real data. Vaccine certificates work and they get people vaccinated now so we can get to the 90% herd immunity. This is not a hard position. Politicians should not apologize for protecting the greatest number of people in a deadly virus with a miracle cure and proven incentives. This is not difficult. I know there is about a 15 or 10 or 20% people who are worried. That's fine. But it is the data on vaccine passports works. The data on the vaccine is overwhelming. There is no rational argument not to do it. So you're damn right it's good that Ontario is doing this. And Alberta better stop their Swiss cheese idea of not really doing it because people are dying. This is a moment of leadership. When there is a deadly pandemic, you protect the lives of our citizens. The number one job of any leader is security of the most. And for kids under 12 who haven't yet been vaccinated and their parents, they're going to school, they're scared. So let's get this discussion. And I'm happy to hear from you, but I'm telling you, there are times when you got to understand the moment and the data and draw a line. So we'll talk about the Ontario vaccine passport, 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. But you're looking at one person who's thinking about that woman at the airport today and saying, it's about time and let's get moving on this stuff. Your thoughts next on the Evan Solomon Show.
So
sorting through the changes. Here's Evan Solomon.
Welcome back to the program. Oh, man, let's do it. So Ontario has just released their vaccine passport. Quebec's got one, and BC's got one, and Alberta's got not really one, sort of one-ish. The Jason Kenney, maybe. I'm not going to do a whole. It's very frustrating to the mayors in the big cities of Calgary and Edmonton. I want your calls on that, your reaction to the vax passport. Let's get it because it's going to affect everybody's life. You know where I stand. These things are incentives. We've got to get to herd immunity, 85, 90%. Let's kick COVID ass. Why is this so hard? We know how to, like, the science is there. The vaccine works. Vaccine passports incentivize people. And if I was selling it, if I was in charge, it would be quite simple. Just make sure there's a sunset clause, because people are legitimately worried about the size of government. That's a real concern. I'm a civil liberties person too. So if you're in government, you say this: we're going to do this, and as soon as we get to herd immunity, it's gone. It's called the sunset clause. It'll be built into any legislation. Nothing can stay. We will purge the data. Nothing will stay as soon as the vaccine is, or the pandemic is over. I assure you, and put that in legislation. It is not hard. We did it during the 9/11 attacks. We had enhanced security, anti-terror legislation that infringed on civil liberties to allow our security forces to protect us. But they came with a sunset clause, so there's a review. The public needs assurances that there is not mission creep on behalf of the government. I understand that, but this isn't hard. Why are we pretending this is a brand new issue? 2 + 2 still equals 4 in a new world. 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. Here is the Premier of Ontario announcing the vaccine passport now in place in Ontario.
As of today, Ontarians will need to provide proof of vaccination before entering certain high-risk indoor settings, including restaurants, bars, casinos, theaters, and gyms. These settings were chosen based on the advice of the Chief Medical Officer of Health.
Yeah. And Doug Ford says he acknowledges that people are concerned.
I know that this is a divisive issue, and that's understandable. I want you to know that I hear you. Our government understands your concerns. And it's no secret that I was reluctant to use this tool. But our highest concern, what keeps me up at night, is ensuring we never lose our hard-fought progress.
Listen, I'm glad any leader is reluctant to infringe on people's civil liberties. But this is not difficult. There's a deadly pandemic that is killing people and killing our economy, killing people's life experiencing, causing mental health anguish, endangering families, endangering children, endangering the elderly. We've lived through it for 19 months. It's killed millions of people around the world. We have a miracle cure. People were furious that Justin Trudeau didn't get the vaccine quick enough. Now you've got a free vaccine, not one shot, two shots, and you'll get a third shot if you want one. We're ahead of the world now. It's free. And now we're pandering to the 15, 20% of people who are preventing the rest of society from reaching herd immunity and killing this thing. We got to do this not just in Canada, but around the world. So, yeah, I think he's got it. Let's do this. Vaccine certificates work. They will get this thing going. Now, but I'm happy to talk about this. I keep thinking about that woman this morning whose job every day is to meet strangers at the airport. And she's basically living in protective fear, gloves, masks. Ugh, it was awful. People, this is not that. This is the moment. This is the moment. Diana, what's up? Or Diane, what's up?
Hi, Evan. How you doing? Like your program.
Thanks, Diane. What's your sense?
Well, I know Ford's like in a catch-22, but, you know, he wants to grow the economy and the government can't go on and on and on, okay, feeding everybody and hoping to get a million jobs when you've got 90% of women staying at home because they don't know if the kids are going to be called in at the house because there's an outbreak. That's what's happening to my daughter. She makes $100,000 a year, and she has to stay home because her husband's a fireman, and he has to be out there. So as last year, the daycares went bankrupt, so she had to stay home. Right. And now that he's in school and kindergarten, okay, it's only three times that they had an outbreak. She had to go out there and pick him up. So it's never ending. So I don't understand these people, okay, that don't want to get vaccinated. I'm sure they have probably children also, and they're going to school, you know. So it's never ending. This pandemic will never end. So I think government has to, you know, do something about it. And like you said, it's up to a lot of people now are getting vaccinated because of this. So hopefully...
Get her done. I tell you, if the message of the election was get back to work, politicians, and get her done, this is part of it. Get this done. Diane, I hope your daughter's okay and the grandkids are okay. Thank you, Diane. Let me go to Steve in the big smoke there. What's up, Steve?
Hey, Evan. So I'm on your side completely. I understand everything that's going on and that needs to go on, but I and many people like me have questions, and I'm hoping you can answer those questions.
Go for it.
So just to be clear, when I'm at the gym, my trainer doesn't have to be vaccinated. When I'm in a retail store, the sales clerk doesn't have to be vaccinated. My server at a restaurant doesn't have to be vaccinated. When I'm in a mall and I want to go to the food court after going into 20 stores, I have to prove I'm vaccinated. Well, there's no barrier whatsoever. I'm just wondering, just honestly, Evan, if you can just tell me where the science is in that.
It's not the science that's confused. It's the administration of the policies. You have raised an absolutely amazing question, and I appreciate it. I'm with you 100%. You know what pisses people off? You know what confuses people? You know what casts doubt? Confusion. That's why I'm saying this is not hard. Well, you know, you can go to your gym, but don't wear a mask and breathe here. Like, I get it. You know what? All that stuff is happening because there was not a clear message at the start, which is if you're double vaccinated, go to your gym. And if you knew everyone there was double vaccinated, then the gym owner can, you know, wear a mask or just everyone's fine. If everyone was proven to be double vaccinated, then there could be a much simpler policy. But when you're running around a world where you're vaccinated once and she's vaccinated twice and he's vaccinated and there's no medical exemption, there's got to be medical exemption for the few people that can't get a vaccine. I'm totally about that. But then you're going to get these idiotic inconsistencies, Steve, and people go, like, I don't understand it. And it throws the science in doubt when the science is not in doubt. Get a double vaccination. It's much harder to transmit. It's much harder to get hurt. And then we can move on. But the fact is we don't have herd immunity. We haven't until this moment in Ontario or Quebec or BC had clarity on that. And you're 100% right. So, you know, let's keep fertilizing doubt by inconsistency. We're finally getting some real consistency and then we can be a little better. But yeah, you're seeing the fruits of a lot of, frankly, lack of leadership, and I appreciate the call. So you're right. So I have no problem with your comment. Evan, I'm a paramedic. I'm also a volunteer firefighter. Every day I go on calls. I have to explain to some of the guys why they should be vaccinated, that I'm actually transporting sick people when I'm in my full-time job, and that I'm actually seeing people die, but they keep reciting the Facebook rabbit hole data as if it's reality. I don't know your name. But A, thanks for your work as a paramedic and a volunteer firefighter. And you're the person, I'm totally with you. You just want to know that everybody that you're seeing is double vaxxed. Because you know what? It's stressful enough to be a firefighter and a paramedic. And there's going to be people that you know aren't vaxxed. But a vaccine passport with a sunset clause will help someone like this, who's out there when you need an emergency. They're jumping in a truck to save your butt. Right? This is just, history demands leadership. History demands leadership. You got to pick a side on a moment like this. And this isn't a side. This is not two sides. There's a 90% side and a 10%, you know, emotion. Plant the flag. Let's get over this. We'll take a break. We got lots more to come. Stay with us.
making sense of the latest news. You're listening to The Evan Solomon Show.
Hey, welcome back to the program, everybody. Great comments I got from all of you about these vaccine passports. I know that this is an issue everyone's talking about, but, you know, for me, I just keep trying to figure this out. I feel like I'm having a debate with someone that says, you know, Evan, you can pour apple juice in your car and you get great mileage. And I said, no, you can't. Yeah, I know a guy. I'm like, yeah, I get, maybe there was some guy that can run his car on apple juice. I don't know. There's no data on that. Maybe there's one person, but, you know, this isn't a debate. But I don't like gasoline. I don't like batteries. I don't like electrical. Okay, then don't get on the road with your little apple juice cart. Like, this is the vaccine. That vaccine certificates are going to say, you got to prove that you're vaccinated so we can get back to real life. The greatest number of people. If you have an irrational fear of them, you're going to have... If you have a medical reason, I get it. You should get an exemption. But if you just have an irrational fear of vaccines and some misunderstanding of how freedom actually works in a civil society, and you have never read the charter and you don't understand anything about reasonable limits, and I guess you're out there protesting speed limits and seat belts and all sorts of other restrictions on your perfect freedom that has never existed in any civil society, okay, have at her. But you ain't holding back the world. Colin DeMello is CTV's Queen's Park Bureau Chief, and Ontario's finally on the vaccine. They've rolled out their vaccine passport. I know there was a reluctance, Colin, but let's just get there. Doug Ford didn't want to do it. He keeps saying, okay, but he's doing it. What finally, you know, pushed him over the line on this?
Well, the premier acknowledged it himself, Evan. Today he said it was the business community. He heard from the Ontario Chamber of Commerce and a number of other business groups who had said, listen, if it's vaccine passports or shutting down during the fourth wave, we would prefer the vaccine passports to keep us open. I mean, this is obviously not the panacea. This doesn't end the pandemic. I mean, there are cases that are still going to be spreading, but they said at least keep us open during the fourth wave. And that was what seemed to convince a very reluctant premier to actually get on board with this. But one thing that's interesting to note, on the first day that the vaccine passports take effect in Ontario, the premier is already looking towards the end of the program. I mean, he's saying in no uncertain terms, you know, we will lift the vaccine passport requirements as soon as it's no longer necessary. He said it will not last one additional day than we need it to last. But the question is what are the parameters then? What are the conditions needed to actually lift them? And that is the one answer that one question that the premier simply will not answer.
Yeah, but a sunset clause is not terrible. I mean, we don't know what's going to trigger the sunset, but at least there's a sense that, you know, okay, you know, the government vaccine passport is going to have an end date. That seems rational, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the premier is, I think, trying to make this as appealing as possible to a lot of people, right? For the people who say vaccine passports are necessary, well, here they are. They are they're there and available for you. For the people who say, I don't want a vaccine passport, this is infringing on my civil liberties, he's also acknowledging it. He says, I understand how you feel, and that's why he's making it clear this is not going to be our forever. This is going to be a temporary measure until it's no longer necessary.
So let's talk about this, because I don't even know how many people are against this. The business community's for this. Most parents who are sending their kids to school want to make sure they want to get their kids vaccinated, you know. Anecdotally, you talk to anybody who's working at an airport, they'd like everybody to be double vaxxed. What exactly will be required here? Like, let's say, what do you need these vaccine passports and how do you get one?
So there are a number of ways. One, you can actually just go to the provincial vaccine booking website, and that will allow you to either do one of two things, either book a vaccine or download your vaccine receipt. Once you download that, you can just, you know, keep a hard copy with you, or you could keep it on your phone, show that plus your driver's license, and you can get in. This is only going to apply to non-essential businesses. So, you know, going to the grocery store, pharmacy, et cetera, that is still, you know, you can still be unvaccinated and access those services.
And by the way, that's totally understandable. God forbid you ever had to say, I couldn't get my food. No, I get that.
Absolutely. There are some exemptions, though. I mean, you can go to, so you will have to be vaccinated to dine indoors, to go inside of a gym, to go to a movie, a concert, you know, even to go to like a theater show. You will have to be fully vaccinated. But there are a lot of exemptions that the province kind of said these kind of make sense. So, for instance, you can go place an order at a restaurant or pick up your order, and you don't have to be vaccinated. You could go use the washroom inside of a restaurant if you're eating on the patio, because you don't have to be vaccinated to eat on the patio. There are some that, you know, don't make sense. So, for instance, if you're going to a gym where, you know, the risk, according to provincial officials, is high, if you're going to a gym and you're working out, you have to be vaccinated in Ontario. But your trainer does not have to be vaccinated. So that kind of a nuance is what some critics are saying doesn't make sense and the province should eliminate.
Okay. Is there any pushback here?
So we're not hearing a lot of, like, any official group pushing back, other than, you know, the business community saying, if you're going to bring in the vaccine passport, at least lift capacity limits on businesses. But, you know, I would suggest to you that the pushback would probably be very quiet, or perhaps, you know, in one-on-one interactions. Keep in mind, so when they announced vaccine passports would take effect on September 22nd, they made that announcement on the 1st of September. In those, you know, 21 days, there were about 125,000 people who went to go get vaccinated. Oh, actually, sorry, I have the number. It's 295,000 people who went to go get vaccinated. And that's their first dose. So it would actually work to convince some people who are reluctant to get off the sidelines to get their vaccine. But there are still 1.9 million Ontarians, 12 plus, who are eligible, who have yet to get their first dose. So we don't know what it will take to convince those people to get their first dose, but this is obviously, you know, targeted at them, trying to get them into a vaccine clinic.
Yeah. It's just so interesting, Colin. I wonder what the polling is like on this. I just, you know, when the United States says you need a proof of vax to travel, when Quebec has it, when BC has it, like, at what point does this become an issue where people are crying about it and screaming about it and worried about it until it just becomes normal? And again, the caveat is, one, there should be exemptions for people with medical conditions. Number two, I really do believe that the sunset clause is really important. There should be now you're right. We should have a better understanding of what the sunset clause is, right? So we can have some real accountability. I think that's a key issue, right?
Well, I think that's where you get greater buy-in, right? I mean, if people understand, if people who are uncomfortable with this idea understand that there is going to be some kind of an end to it and understand what it would take to get there. I mean, we don't know the when, right? Because if you look at masking as an example, we don't know when we could be in a position where masks are no longer required. And, you know, we don't want to be in a position of removing the requirement and then reimposing it. And so I think the province doesn't want to be in that position either. They don't want to, you know, button themselves into certain parameters, because then we will be watching those parameters.
Yeah, exactly, of course.
And once we achieve it, then the question is, well, why haven't we lifted it just yet? So I don't know if the province wants to kind of paint themselves into a corner, but at the same time, for people who are reluctant and want to know all of the answers before they say, okay, I'll do this, you know, giving them that answer and not just saying there could be some, you know, a wind down period at some point in the future might get them on board with a divisive, as the premier calls it, a divisive policy.
Before I let you go, any thoughts on the federal election and what played out in the province of Ontario?
Well, so it's going to be really interesting. You know, Ontario has this unique history of electing contrasting governments, right? If there's a Liberal government provincially, you know, when we had Dalton McGuinty and Kathleen Wynne, it was Stephen Harper federally. And then as soon as Justin Trudeau came in, we got Doug Ford here provincially. So I think, you know, the progressive conservatives, I spoke to a cabinet minister one day who said to me, you know, clearly, he said, the worst case scenario for us would have been an O'Toole majority.
Interesting.
And the best case scenario is actually a Liberal minority, because it gives the premier this ability to be kind of like a strong man in the face of a weaker federal government and elicits more out of the federal government. So,
well, they got what they wanted. Guess what? Yeah. The message from voters, get back to work. They did. And let's see if they actually get some work. Colin DeMello, CTV's Queen's Park Bureau Chief. Awesome work as always, sir. Thank you.
Yeah, good to talk to you, Evan.
Yeah, you too. Coming up. So really, we're coming up to a really important week, Truth and Reconciliation Day, and we got Roseanne Archibald, the Assembly of First Nations National Chief, to talk about what needs to happen. Some frank talk next.
As your world changes, we adapt to get your answers. Now more with Evan Solomon.
Welcome back to the program. You may not even know that September 30th was declared a federal statutory holiday called the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation back in July. So this is the first time it's ever happened. The government says it's going to be, quote, a day of quiet reflection or a participation in a community event to look at the legacy of residential institutions. You know my view on, I always call them that because they're so disgraceful. But no one's ever done this, designated paid holiday. It's the first time in Canada, and we're trying to figure out how you market. And many, it's going to be very personal, so there's no right or wrong way. But one thing we have to do is have just honest talk. And one thing, the backbone of any society is the ability to ask respectful questions and conversations about things, not to just repeat things that are, quote, right and condemn things that are wrong, but to actually have a real exchange of understanding. I always call education, and I remember growing up, and the pleasurable discomfort of learning. You know, when you're learning something, you assume that you don't know it, and there's a little discomfort. No one likes to run around thinking, I don't know. But education is the pleasurable discomfort of learning. And this is a day where the country is learning about what has been called by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission a cultural genocide, and many, many leaders call it a straight-up genocide. Institutions that are government-sanctioned, run by churches and by governments that are essentially meant to not only strip the culture, the language, the identity of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Indigenous people, but essentially many times they tortured, abused them, and killed them, and left many of them in unmarked graves, and that we're discovering them or recovering them. So I want to have a frank conversation. I want to introduce you to someone who's been on this program before, and it's Roseanne Archibald. She's the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, and she's the kind of person that will have a real, honest, frank, human conversation about anything, and I think we need those. And National Chief, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Morning. Evan, I think it's morning here where I am anyway.
I don't even know where you are. Where are you?
Brentwood Bay near Victoria, BC.
Oh man. Oh, you're up. I've really got you up early. You're so good. Are you, would you call yourself a morning person or a night person? Because, you know, at this point, even if I stay up late, I just get up early anyway. Like I can't help it now.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a night owl, I'd say, for sure.
Yeah. So let's talk about this. I'm really concerned that people think, I don't know what I'm, quote, supposed to do. You're not supposed to do anything on these days, but I think there's a lot of misunderstanding. Before we get to, like, what politicians have to do, and you and I have had those discussions, let's just talk to people listening in their cars, in their businesses right now, National Chief, who have questions, like, you know, I'm trying to figure stuff out. I'm just trying to learn. And some people have said to me, I'm just afraid to ask questions because I don't want to offend anybody. So we're still at that level. I don't want to go back to square one, but how do you approach people? Like, what's your sense of how people ought to regard this day for the first time being celebrated or marked across the country?
Yeah, it's definitely not a day of celebration because it is about recognizing that genocide did occur and that our children were the victims of that. So we are seeing thousands of our children being recovered from unmarked graves. And that really is a difficult thing to digest for anyone because we all love our children and our grandchildren. And when we imagine ourselves in, you know, that's empathy, when we can imagine what that feels like, it creates such an overwhelming emotion in people. And that's what I'm seeing, is that people are looking and they're wondering, like, what can I do? How can I help? And I think the first thing that Canadians are doing, which is really helpful right now, is that they are being empathetic, that they are beginning to understand the truth of this country. And when we interrupt a myth or a story that we have believed all of our lives, perhaps, you know, in Canada, for example, for generations, and we interrupt that and we say, by the way, none of that was true, that's a really shocking moment for everyone. It's a real moment of awakening. And my call to people is to stay awake, because it's important to still to not begin to shut down and say, well, there's nothing I can do about it, because there is a lot people can do about it. So one of the things they can do is keep talking to their government officials, so their MPs, their MPPs, their mayors, and say, what are you going to do about this? How are you going to create justice for these children? What are you going to do in our town or in our province or in, you know, federally to mark this day and make it a day that has meaning, as opposed to being just a statutory holiday where we just take that time and, you know, do other things? We have to mark it properly, and we have to make it a day of learning and a very solemn day of remembering, in the same way that we do with Remembrance Day, that, you know, we take that time, the moment of silence. We think about the sacrifices and the difficulties of war. And on this day, we're doing the same thing, but we're thinking about our children. And
yeah.
How do we keep our children safe? And how do we change the system so that this never happens again?
Yeah, I'm speaking to Roseanne Archibald, the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations. I also think people can ask any question, right? Like if someone said to you, National Chief, like, you know, how bad was a residential school? Or like, why is there so much? And, you know, I don't blame them if they haven't read the Truth and Reconciliation Report. They weren't taught. No one was taught this for many, many years. Can I ask you, are there any such thing as bad questions right now? Or should people just, I mean, as long as their intention is not to be hurtful and divisive, but are there bad questions, or should people just be welcome to talk to their neighbors, their community members there, and just ask the question, you know, to figure things out?
Yeah, because if they don't understand, then it is about finding that information. It's about trying to get a deeper understanding of what happened, so there aren't any bad questions. There aren't any, you know, questions that I think there are difficult questions, and you want to be sensitive,
yes.
Right? You want to be aware that if you're asking a residential school survivor, for example, you don't want to trigger them, and you don't want to, you know, push them back into their own trauma. So you do want to be sensitive. But the intent is about learning. And I think that's how you preface any of your questions. Like, I really want to know, I really care about this.
Yeah.
This really matters to me. And what can I do about it? What can I do as an individual? Mm. And I think ultimately one of the biggest exercises of personal power is during elections. When we cast our vote collectively, we collectively elect a government.
Right.
And that's a powerful moment.
National Chief, because I'm coming to the end of my segment, I just got to tell you, you're one of the most approachable, brilliant people on this. And I can't tell you how much I thank Roseanne Archibald, National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, for joining us today.
You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
Okay, since we're talking about vaccines, and I'm getting tons of texts at 7:10:10, I say, Evan, you know, I know you always say that there's overwhelming medical, scientific, and rational proof to get the vaccine and to install vaccine passports, and then you always kind of add, but if you have a medical exemption, we should make sure, but you kind of gloss over it. Why don't you talk about people that may have had an adverse reaction? Are you afraid of that? And I answer no. The very opposite. As you know, like there's real things happening, and let's talk about them. I don't go down conspiracy rabbit holes. People send me, hey, but there's a doctor in Scotland. Yeah, I get it. What I do with those, just so you know, when I get sent that stuff, I usually send them to an epidemiologist like Dr. Bogosh or somebody. And I say, does this merit investigation? If they say, yeah, there's some stuff, then we'll do it. But if it doesn't, if there's overwhelming evidence that says, no, this is just a, you know, you're chasing shadows here, I don't do it. But in late August, BC did their vaccine passport. We know Ontario's rolling theirs out today. People over the age of 12 need to show this proof of vaccine for non-essential activities like indoor dining in restaurants, attending ticketed sport events or weddings. And on September 13th, proof of one vaccine dose was officially required. And Dr. Bonnie Henry, BC's provincial health officer, said back in August, there will be no exemptions. Get this, though. And I remember I was on radio saying this was a huge mistake, that she was making a major mistake. Go back and listen to my show. Here's what Dr. Bonnie Henry said then.
If there are those rare people who have a medical reason why they can't be immunized, these are discretionary events that we're talking about. So they will not be able to attend those events through this period of time of high risk. There are no exemptions for other reasons.
Terrible idea. A, because we didn't know the sunset clause, like when will these stop? And if why wouldn't you make exemptions? We make it at school. That was my argument then. If your kid has a medical exemption because they're allergic to a vaccine for measles and mumps, because there's herd immunity, we grant it. And Dr. Bonnie Henry made a mistake in my view there. In Ontario, anyone up to the age of 12 today must provide a written document from a physician or a nurse practitioner on official letterhead stating there is a medical reason for the exemption. And even though these are rare and they're limited to people who have had adverse reaction, they happen. And you know how we know? Because Cody Darnell is a BC resident who had an adverse reaction to the vaccine. And she's a mother of three. She's a blogger. She has Vancouver Mom's Top Blogger of 2018. Her blog, Help Cody Heal, chronicles her experiences as a mom, a wife, and a wheelchair user. And Cody joins us now. Hi, Cody.
Hi.
I know that this is a rare thing to have these adverse reactions, but they're real. And because it's rare, we shouldn't just ignore it. What was your reaction to the vaccine?
So I had my first vaccine, and within about 10 minutes, my tongue was very thick and tingly. I eventually lost the ability to swallow. And after being observed for an amount of time, two doctors at the vaccination center decided to inject epinephrine into my leg. And then I went in an ambulance to the hospital where I received steroids and more antihistamines to control the reaction.
What was and what happened?
It get controlled. So, I had the anaphylactic reaction to, the Pfizer vaccine. And eventually, yes, it settled and I saw an allergist, who agreed with me that it was reasonable to not go for the second vaccine.
But you are still, I want this to be clear, Cody, you are not sort of an anti-vaxxer because of this. You support, if it's healthy, you support people getting the vaccine for COVID-19.
Yeah, absolutely. My husband is double vaxxed. I got my parents, obviously I was concerned about them with their age. We got them sorted. I went for my first vaccine and I was fully planning to get the second. I'd never had an anaphylactic reaction before. It was very scary. And it shocks me to think that it would be an issue, that people would think I should just go get the second vaccine anyway. That really did surprise me.
Right. Listen, it is rare that this happens, but it happens. It happens with every vaccine. There are people that have these reactions if you get the polio vaccine. I understand that. That doesn't make it better or worse. It was probably bloody scary. And
yeah.
Now the question is, you live in BC, Cody. You don't have an exemption. So this vaccine passport really shuts you out, and it's not your fault. How does that make you feel?
It's very frustrating. Like even my daughter, she's 6 years old, when I was telling them, she was like, but don't they realize you had an allergic reaction? Like it just, she couldn't even comprehend that after like what we went through, that it wouldn't be considered reasonable for me not to get a second vaccine, and that it wouldn't be considered reasonable for me to be exempted from some sort of passport. BC has come out and said, well, you can be exempted if you're allergic to all the vaccines. So basically they want me to try something else, which there is data to prove that there is crossover between different ingredients. Also, there is issues with the AstraZeneca vaccine showing increased blood clots, and being someone who's paralyzed, I already have an increased risk of blood clots. So there are issues. Like, my medical situation is complicated, and I do think that if my medical team agrees that in my case it is reasonable not to get a vaccine, that should be respected by the provincial government.
I agree with you 100%. It's so, the idea that your rights are prohibited in any way, shape, or form for no fault of your own. It's not like you've said, I don't trust these. You had a terrible reaction. Thank God you're okay. And this is, I think your situation is really important to talk about. And, you know, I know there's a reluctance to probably get media on this because people say, well, if we talk to Cody, that's going to discourage people from getting the vaccine. Again, common sense.
And that's not.
It doesn't. That's not true, is it?
It's not. And even like when I originally wrote a blog post about this right after it happened, the rational part of me doesn't regret going for it. I waited the 15 minutes. The reaction was caught and it was dealt with. But to me, that doesn't mean, oh, I go to a hospital to get a second vaccine so that it can be dealt with again. There are allergic reactions that sometimes epinephrine doesn't work. And then if we're going to require a third booster, then what, I have to do that again. I feel like there needs to be a line where we respect that people cannot do this.
Yeah, you don't want to risk a very deadly anaphylactic shock for your second dose, and you've got one dose, which, frankly, one dose still gives you pretty darn good protection. Not perfect, hell of a lot better than nothing. It's better, though, right? Like the doctors are saying, it's better than getting nothing.
It is. And when you look on the World Health Organization, they say that 50% effectiveness of a well-used vaccine, so lots of people who take it, will help control the pandemic. Johnson & Johnson is a one-shot. It has a 66% effective rate. AstraZeneca is a 63% effective rate.
Right.
The numbers for a single shot of Pfizer seem to vary widely. It's hard to find an actual number, but it is anywhere from, they've said, 50 to 84% effective. So I do have, immunity. I could be just as much as someone who's received some of the other vaccines.
So just real quick, because I got to catch a second here. Did you see the Ontario restrictions? Do you think their exemptions are good enough, Cody?
You know what? I haven't looked at them closely
right,
enough.
Yeah.
I do believe, though, that we should respect our doctors enough to look at their patients and make an informed choice for them. If they truly feel like they should be exempt, that needs to be looked at.
Cody Darnell, if you've had a reaction like you had, you required medical intervention post-vaccine within that window that everyone talks about, I 100% agree with you. We've got to be reasonable and accommodate people like Cody Darnell, a BC resident, a mom. She had an adverse reaction. She's not an anti-vaxxer. She's done her bit. And she should not be punished or curtailed because of that. This is not that hard. You got to help people like Cody. Thank you, Cody. I really appreciate it. I got to take a break, though. We'll be right back.
Finding answers to all your questions. You're listening to The Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back to the program. I feel like we're doing a lot of stuff on medical stuff today. And you know what? I don't mind that. I actually think one of the themes of this last 36-day election, where I know we went around the political mulberry bush and the message is just get back to work. One of the themes is simply security. Like, what is the basic level of security we all want? And I just want to pull back the curtain a bit. What I do kind of on many, many days in the morning is I send out messages to various political leaders around the country of all stripes, and I just ask a question. Like, one of the questions I asked to a bunch of them this morning was, what do you think the message voters sent was? And a lot of them said, just get back to work. Like, get back to work, which we talked about yesterday on this program. But one of the other debates was, what's the level of security that people want from... And politicians are elected, first and foremost, to provide a basic level of security. Now, there's a real debate about, are they also there to provide a basic level of prosperity? Or are they there to have a basic level of security and then you're free to pursue your own level of prosperity? Those are legitimate political debates. Some people say you need a basic income, some say no. So those are good issues. And there's no right answer because people disagree on that. But there is a basic level of security that we have enshrined in our Constitution, the right to freedom, the right to health, pursue your religious freedom, and the right to health, right? We don't live in a society where if you have a heart attack, you can't get health care. You go to a hospital and they say, sorry, this guy's got a visa. They're worth $2 million. They're going to get the doctor first. But I'll tell you what's happening. We don't have that system. But there's a lot of people that can't even get a bloody doctor. Now, you tell me if that's right in Canada, a G7 country. Well, Simone Harker, a Nova Scotia resident, waited nearly 2 hours for her diabetic husband, Keith, to be triaged in a Sackville hospital in the ER in July. He'd been unwell and tragically, Simone's husband died in the lobby in front of everyone. And now, that's the kind of situation we got to talk about. Keith, and I'm proud to welcome Simone here. My deep condolences for all our listeners about what happened to your husband, your dear husband, Keith.
Well, actually, today is 2 month anniversary for his death. It happened on July 22nd, and he was a diabetic for many, many years, 30-plus years. And at first, he was a diabetic that wouldn't listen, and that went on for a few years. But as he aged, and he was a little wiser, and I worked with him to try to explain that if he doesn't make changes soon, it's going to affect parts of his body and his health tremendously. So he did. And we always ate properly. We ate good meals and we exercised, walking. And anyway, he was doing really well with his diet and everything, and his insulin. He was on two different types of insulin a day. And then he told me for a few days, he said, my body doesn't feel right, but I'm not sure what it is. I don't know what's wrong with it. And then one day he said, I'm having trouble urinating. And I said, I bet you that's a UTI. Let's get to the doctor. Mm. So we got to the doctor. Doctor diagnosed him with a UTI, called in a prescription for him, which I picked up right away. He had two pills that day, and he was fine. We went out to dinner that night with friends. And then as the night went on, he seemed to deteriorate quickly. And so that morning, he couldn't even stand up. I couldn't get him out of bed. He had no energy whatsoever, and he couldn't feel his legs. So I called for help, had son-in-law come in and help me get him dressed, put him in a wheelchair. He took us up to Emerge and said, call me as soon as you're ready to come home. When I walked into Emerge, I could have died. It was packed. It was 9:30 yeah. in the morning. And their processes is what I feel needs... revamping big time.
Yeah, the process, like the fact that what happened to Keith, everyone listening, by the way, across this country, they experienced the long waits at emergency rooms. Mm-hmm. There's 5 million Canadians that don't even have a family doctor. They don't have primary care. They got to walk in. And you know why? What happens is they don't have a doctor, so they go to Emerge.
That's right. That's exactly right.
That's what's happening here. And that... Like, I just want people to understand that's what happened to your husband. Like, the emergency,
Right. When I looked around, there was a young girl in front of us. She seemed to have a swollen ankle, and she was hopping on her foot. So I think she needed an x-ray. I looked around, and there were people like in different sections because there wasn't enough room right in the actual lobby. And, you know, they were talking to the ones next door and laughing and carrying on. And I'm thinking, so I seen a paramedic come into the lobby, and I approached her, and I said, my husband is extremely sick. It came on suddenly, and he is diabetic, and I'm really concerned. I would like to call an ambulance to come to this ER and take him into Halifax. She said, you're going to have to wait regardless of where you go. You may as well just stay here and wait. You can talk
Although, to be fair, rural areas are even worse.
I know. And then she said, go talk to the lady in triage. So I waited for that patient to come out. And when I went in, I said, my husband is extremely sick. He's diabetic, and his sugars, I'm sure, are high. And I'm concerned. And she said, have a seat. I'll take you as soon as I can. Well, the process is there's five chairs on one side, five chairs on the other side. If you're on the right side, that's when you go up to get triaged when that person comes, when someone comes out. I was in the last chair, the 10th chair, when I arrived. And so some people were taking 15, 20 minutes in there to get triaged. Mm-hmm. And so after talking to both of them, I didn't have any choices. So I just kept waiting and moving on along and moving along. And my husband at the time just had his head down and his hands up to his head. I don't know if he was asleep or not. Anyway, we got about, there was about three people that she hadn't mm-hmm. seen yet, and when she motioned me in. His blood pressure was 189 over 73. His sugars were 19 point something, and then she did ketones, which were 0.8. I knew all of those numbers are very high. And so then she said, go over to the next window.
Right.
And I went over to there, and I believe, because we haven't gone up to Emerge that often, I believe that's where they give you a bracelet to put on, and then you sit in another area to wait.
Right.
And she was asking me questions, and then I forgot to mention, my husband was vomiting all this time. There was no vomit coming out, but there was it was white foam.
But Simone, just because, you know, you lose your husband 2 months ago today.
Uh-huh.
And this kind of, I mean, this is real, folks. I know it's graphic and I know it's hard. This is life. This is Simone and Keith. And this is what happens. And I know we just had a federal election. And I know mm-hmm. people are talking about COVID all the time. But this is what's really happening. And I just, that's in Nova Scotia, but all around this country, everyone knows this. And I want people to realize that even though this election's over, this is the reality, and, you know, lack of family doctors, long lines in emergency
mm-hmm.
rooms,
mm-hmm.
and it's costing lives. And I just think, you know, I know people are sick of politics right now, and I know the election's over, but, you know, darn it, we didn't talk about this enough in the election, and this is what it's about, too. And I, Simone, our heart goes out to you and your family. I want to thank you for making this story. Unfortunately for you, it's all too real. And it's more personal to all of us now. Simone Harker, Nova Scotia resident who lost her husband, and I just want to make sure we share that story because I think these are the forgotten stories. We talk about COVID and vaccines, but Simone and Keith, we'll keep you in our hearts. Simone, thank you so much. We need doctors. Rural areas need doctors. Urban areas need doctors. Healthcare workers, and we got to solve these problems. This is Canada. Is that the Canada? Is that the Canada that you want? I mean, that's just straight it. So figure it out. We got to figure it out. That's what the message to politicians. Get to work and figure it out. All right, I got to take a short break. When we come back, a story you don't want to miss, a hostage story.
As the story changes, we react. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
Maybe one of the most terrifying things to happen to anyone is to be kidnapped by a radical terror group. And this is what happened. Let me read you an excerpt from a story where you're about to meet someone who's just understood this reality, which dawned on her and her friend, and there's a new book about it. Imagine this. Imagine this moment. He said they were Mujahideen, soldiers fighting in the way of Allah. We were supposed to help them with their mission. At the time, we didn't fully grasp what he was telling us. We thought we'd been kidnapped by a bunch of second-rate bandits who planned to take us to their chief. Maybe he wanted to steal what little money we had. You know what happened? 450 days of captivity. Edith Blay is the author of The Weight of Sand, My 450 Days Held Hostage in the Sahara. Edith and her Italian friend Luca were captured. Well, they were on a road trip in West Africa back in 2018. And Edith joins us now. First of all, I'm so glad you're safe. How are you?
Good. I'm very good. Thank you.
You were on a trip. Were you in a dangerous place? For people who might wonder, why were you there in the first place?
Well, we knew a friend and that was living in Togo, and we were going to join him. And he told us, like, he knew a lot of people that did it often by car from Europe. And he had a friend that just made it, like, the trip 1 week before us. So we were, like, we knew it was dangerous, but we were kind of a little confident if we were doing the right route and being careful that it would be fine.
Tell us how you were captured. What was that moment like?
It was like a still moment. Life stopped for like at least 2 minutes. It's unbelievable. You don't really understand when there's six people like dressed up like they are with AKs in their hands and like blocking the street. You can't do anything, and you know that you have to stop right there, and you don't know what's going to happen. It's terrifying.
And then that began a 450 days of captivity. Were they threatening your life? Like, was it, we just want to keep you alive for money, or were your lives in danger?
No, they wanted to stay alive.
Did you know that right away? Or were you like, oh my God, they're going to kill me?
Well, at first I didn't think they were going to kidnap us. I thought they were going to steal everything we had and just maybe kill us and leave us in the big park, because when they got us out of the car, they made us go into this big park in the trees, and nobody could see us, and they left with the car. So I was like, okay, it's finished. And then I understand that they were going to kidnap us, and at first they make us understand if we don't do anything wrong and we just follow, we're going to be safe. But that's it.
Where did they take you?
Well, we got caught close to Benin in Burkina Faso, so close to the border. We went up 20 days by motorcycle. After that, they transferred us into these trucks that went into the sands, and we went up, still up north to the Sahara Desert, into the desert. And we stayed north Mali for all that time.
And you're North Mali in the Sahara Desert. And tell me something. Like 450 days, you spent a year and a half there. What was the most difficult moment? Like, what was the moment? Did you have a low moment there? I mean, you must have had many, but do you remember the most difficult moment?
Actually, at first I was with my friend Luca, and then we got separated after 3 months. And then I was put with three women. And then I stayed 5 months with them. It was a little easier with the women. With Luca, it was quite hard because we had to always stay hidden. Like, so we were just like laying down day after day, 24 hours. It was quite hard. But it was the hardest when I got separated from the women, and I was 6 months all alone with the groups. So
There were other people captive.
Yeah, but at that point, the 6 months, I was all alone with the groups. They change always. We change guardians every month or so. And we changed regions. I was with Luca in one region, and then I was with the woman in another region, and then I was put up north, north, north with the Tuaregs, and I was alone for 6 months. That was
You were alone, hard. Like in solitary or just with your captors?
Me and my captors.
Edith, you know, a lot of people are listening are going to ask you if they physically harmed you in any way. I know these. I don't mean to trigger you, but that's going to be the obvious question.
Mm-hmm. No, actually, it was fine. If you don't do anything wrong, they don't like just hurt you for nothing. there's some people I know that try to escape, so that they got beaten up, but that's pretty
much
it.
They did get beaten?
These people that try to escape, yeah.
So how did you get, how did you escape in the end? Like, how did you get out after 450 days?
Yeah, well, this is a really long story, but at one point when I was 6 months alone, there's a chef that came and met me, and he told me that I had to convert. And, yeah, it was, well, a funny moment. And then at that point, I decided to do it because I thought I got a video from Luca that was saying he converted, and I thought maybe if we were both converted, we could be together. And actually, that's what happened.
So you converted to Islam, and you were reunited with Luca, your partner?
Yeah, exactly. At that point, we got reunited like maybe 1 week after. And when I was with Luca again, we just decided, like, let's just do it. We're not getting out of here, so let's just try.
And so how did you actually, why did they release you in the end?
They didn't release, we escaped, actually. We waited for the full moon, and there was a big wind at one night. So after the last prayer, me and Luca, it was dark because the moon wasn't up when the sun went down. So we had like a couple of hours in the darkness, and we left. And because of the wind, they didn't hear us leave, and they didn't see us because of the total darkness. And
so you just ran out. Like you got, even though you'd seen people get beaten when they, so you got, and where did you go that when you escaped?
We went west. We were hoping, because you don't exactly know where you are. We were hoping that if we were going west, we would hit the big road that would go from the Kidal to Gao and Tombuktu. We're just hoping, like, it was our best guess that west would be the best guess. So we were going west for like 8 hours at night.
That must have been terrifying. You must have been terrified when you were running and escaped. Like, that, if they caught you, they could have killed you.
Yeah, well, Luca tried once before when we were separated, and he got caught. And he was chained for like 6 months. And yeah, it wasn't funny. So he was kind of hesitating when we were talking about escaping again. But we had nothing to lose, I think, at that point. So
you, and you got away. And were you picked up in a car? Is that what happened?
Yeah, we in the morning we found a big road. And it was like a big track. So we were hoping maybe there was a merchandise trucks that would pass. We would trust them. And that's what happened. There was three trucks that passed. And the third one stopped and they picked us up. And they brought us to UN.
Oh, my God. And you're 450 days held hostage in the Sahara. That, just out of interest, do you have long-term sort of mental health scars on this, Edith?
No, not that I know of.
Interesting. Like, because you sound great. I got to be honest. You sound like very, like, okay. I mean, you have a kind of practical side to you, clearly.
Mm-hmm. I think I managed to go through it maybe the right way, or the way that I stayed mentally healthy.
Your book, The Weight of Sand, My 450 Days Held Hostage in the Sahara, I got to tell you, a testament to your resilience as you were moved around, held hostage with your friend Luca, captured on that road in 2018, and somehow you've emerged to tell your story. Thank God you're alive and healthy, and good luck with the book, and thank you for a real, real story of resilience, Edith. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Edith Blay, author of The Weight of Sand. Can you imagine? What I'm amazed, you know, when you ask her, how are you doing? She goes, I think I'm pretty good. Like, that is practical. Oh, man. People are so resilient. Dan Riskin's going to join us next. I'm just going to say this. Astronaut blood can be used to make concrete on Mars. That's all I'm going to say, and then we'll tell you more about it next.
Talking to the newsmakers every day. The conversation continues with Evan Solomon.
Here's a headline that is always going to make it on this program because I don't understand it. Astronaut blood can be used to make concrete on Mars. I have no idea what that means. And so that's why we called Dan Riskin, because when you say blood, Mars, concrete, it's like some kind of category that only Riskin understands. CTV News, science and technology specialist, all around good man. How you doing? It's been a long time. I feel like you've been giving me the Heisman a bit lately.
Well, listen, I've been watching you. You've been everywhere because it's been election week. And so you've been doing a great job, by the way. It's been very fun to hear your thoughts and to see how you're watching things come in and dealing with it, watching you and Lisa, you know, pass the puck back and forth at the desk there. I love seeing you do what you do. So it's been, I've been getting to watch you. So I'm just happy to get two words in this week when there's so much going on politically.
Well, you know what? Thank you, first of all. Now this is amazing coming from a guy who literally is a data hound. So thank you. But I am very happy to jump off the election train for a while because I think people have maybe they'd like a different stop. So how's things going in the world of curious, interesting things that make us go, what the hell? Like, what is this thing?
Yeah. So, okay, here we go. So there's a problem. If you want to go to Mars, you probably want buildings there so that people can live in the buildings. And yes, you can make a big inflatable thing when you first get there. But come on, we want buildings with bricks. Well, the current cost of sending a brick to Mars is estimated at $2 million per brick. And so the cost of building a habitat is prohibitive right now, or at least it's very expensive for most of us. So they've been trying to come up with ideas for how you can make some bricks there. And basically, they went back to medieval technology and said, you know, people used to use dust and the blood of animals, and that worked. So let's try this. So what they did is they took some simulated Martian dust. They have Earth dust that has the same sort of size of particles. And then they tried it with some human blood and a little bit of urine and some sweat and tears and all that stuff, like basically some human fluids, because that's a great place to get liquids because we make all these wastes. Although I like to keep my blood in my body, but you know, I guess I could donate a little to help the brick wall out every once in a while. And so they've come up with this plan, and they basically did material testing on these simulated bricks, and they said they'd be stronger than concrete. So let's do it. This is going to be a plan going forward. And I just feel like that changes the way going to Mars, you know, like what you expect when you get there.
But why would you, like, there's no atmosphere on Mars. You can't really use a brick house. You have to use something that has, you know, that can actually have, you know, is, you know, proof, contains oxygen.
Yeah.
And brick is not good for that. So, like, why would you even want to make a brick there?
Sure. Well, so actually, because the density of the air there is much, much lower than it is on Earth, the huffing and puffing problem is not an issue, right? So, I mean, that's the thing with a brick house. It's resistant against wind, and there's really not much wind to worry about there. But bricks are good for supporting structures and heavy things, right? And so if you're starting to build a multi-layer building or something like that, you could use it for structure to hold the weight, and then you could use your sort of inflatable balloon materials or something else, maybe some kind of, you know, Kevlar sort of bulletproof, very fancy-dancy wall that's maybe good at resisting, not letting the air through, but doesn't hold a weight as well. So it would be one of the materials you'd have available there. But it really speaks to the sort of people thinking about the nitty-gritty of the feasibility. Like, getting people to Mars just seems like, okay, well, can a rocket go there? Yeah, it can. Okay, well, can we have enough food for the trip? Oh, yeah, well, probably. And can a human body survive that trip and walk around after it's been in weightlessness for 9 months without falling down and needing help? Oh, yeah, that's another problem. I guess we have to sort of spin the spaceship while we're going out there to create artificial gravity. And now it's like, well, what about the, you know, what kind of buildings are they going to use to store things, to build the infrastructure for when the next ship comes? And so these are the kinds of nitty-gritty details that have sort of funny answers and really strike home just how far away that is.
It seems now when you travel 9 months to Mars and it's like, Houston, now we're here. And it's like, okay, can you please cut a vein now? We got to start building.
Right.
Now we need your blood. It's like, no, I don't really want to bleed for my job. Like, it seems like we're asking a lot from the astronauts to now not just donate blood for their lives on Mars, but for construction. It does not seem very practical.
No, it doesn't seem practical. And I mean, there's a big question about whether they would adopt this technology, or if they would say, you know what, just pay the $2 million a brick and get those things up there. You know, get Elon to foot the bill. He's got plenty of money.
Yeah, he just got some money. That's like Tuesday for him. That's Tuesday, like at 10 a.m. to 10:01.
Yeah. No, he bleeds money. So I guess there's no problem there. But yeah, the issue is that, you know, people have to think about what they're willing to sacrifice and what they're willing to do. The idea on paper, this is like typical engineers, right? Like, oh, I've done the calculations. It should be fine. You have six astronauts for 2 years. They could make 500 kilograms of bricks. that works fine on paper, but like day in, day out, doing blood draws just to help build a brick wall, it's a very different thing than giving a blood draw to help science or to help somebody who's injured or something like that. And then, you know, on top of that, you know, I alluded to this earlier, but the trip to Mars is going to beat the living daylights out of a human body. Like, you can't be in weightlessness for 9 months and be fine. Like, you're going to be a mess. When people go to the, you know, like Hadfield went for 6 months up to the International Space Station. And I remember when he came back talking about how heavy his tongue felt in his mouth. And he just felt awful. I mean, you're a wreck. And so the idea
that this is saying, like, just so people are asking, like, how much blood? I'll just read the article. Researchers say an astronaut could potentially give enough blood to make a standard red clay brick in 1 month, assuming they donate a liter of blood twice a week. Like, what?
Yeah, there's a, yeah, this again, this is the engineers. They're like, well, technically you'd survive. We've done the calculations.
Thanks, engineers.
Yeah, thanks, engineers. But if the engineers aren't the ones going there, then I'm sure that we'd be like, oh, sorry, we just weren't able to do it this week. Not working. We're losing the communication here. You know, that Han Solo bit with, it's not working, then he shoots the thing.
Yeah.
It's a big ask of astronauts for sure. But it does speak to sort of the kinds of crazy ideas that people have about how we're going to establish a colony there. And people are really, you know, asking the question, why are we going to Mars in the first place? Why are we so obsessed with setting up a colony there when we have this wonderful place back here on Earth? What is it we gain by being on Mars? And so for a lot of people, this is going to make them, you know, it's going to tip the scale. And they're going to say, you know what? I just don't think we need to go to Mars.
I mean, astronauts do a lot. I just wish, this is what I love about science. Like, what was your day like, honey? I don't know. I peed on some dust and tried to make a brick. I sliced my veins to see if I could make concrete with. It's like, honey, are you nuts? These labs seem at least interesting.
Yeah, no, what I like about it is there is some science. Like the fact that your blood clots, like pee doesn't clot, hopefully, if you're healthy, but blood does, right? And so it's those clotting agents that actually come into play and help bind that dust together and make it into a concrete. So it's kind of a cool application of human physiology. And it's neat to think about the fact that you do need blood and urine's not going to be enough because that's just mostly water and it doesn't have those binding agents. And so, you know, they have to think about very carefully what goes into the menu. And maybe they'd be able to improve the technology, maybe bring a little bit of a chemical that would make urine work a little bit better for that job instead of having to use blood. But it's an interesting idea.
You know, now I have my morning mantra too, and it's going to come from Dan Riska. It's going to be pee doesn't clot.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a great. Now you've said that on national radio. Just for the record, guys, in case you thought it was clotting, just a reminder. Pee doesn't clot, straight up.
Yeah, it's one of those things to be grateful for when you pee first thing in the morning. You just say to yourself,
my pee's clotting. All right. I wasn't even going to use that expression, you blank a brick. All right, Dan Riskin, you're the best, sir. I miss you. Let's do this more frequently. What happens every time you're on is I just love it. I learn a lot. Dan Riskin is the greatest. That is the Evan Solomon Show. I'll see you on Power Play tonight. Keep listening to the iHeartRadio Network. And remember, pee doesn't clot. Take that to the bank.